Welcome to Protect the Granite State, a new show that will explore the impacts of Northern Pass on New Hampshire. For those of you who don't know, Northern Pass is a joint corporate venture between Hydro-Québec, a Canadian company, and Eversource, the parent company of PSNH, to build 192 miles of transmission, towers, and lines through New Hampshire to bring power mainly to Massachusetts and Connecticut. I'm Judy Reardon, a senior advisor to Protect the Granite State. We have two great guests today. Our guests today are two local experts on Northern Pass. Jim Monahan is the managing partner of the DuPont Group, a public affairs consulting firm here in Concord, is with me in the studio. Jim is a consultant on energy issues, and I've known him for almost 30 years now, and I can tell you he's the foremost expert on energy markets in New Hampshire. Joining us by phone is Will Abbott, the Vice President of the Society to Protect New Hampshire Forests, the leading conservation and environmental organization in the state. Welcome, Jim and Will. Thank you for being on with me today. Will, I'm going to start with you. Can you give us a basic summary of the costs and benefits of Northern Pass as you see them?
Sure, Judy. I think the starting point for the Forest Society is that the impact of Northern Pass's 192-mile project in New Hampshire, largely the 132 miles, which is above ground and on towers way above tree line, is that the cost to the state of New Hampshire, the scarring of these landscapes, and mind you, it's the landscapes of central and northern New Hampshire are part of the economy as well as part of the social well-being of the people who live there. These economies in central and northern New Hampshire are built around the landscapes. So you scar the landscape, you scar the economy as well as the landscape itself. We just think it's too high a price to pay for the electricity that would be brought in. You know, our organization isn't opposed to the idea of importing electricity from Quebec. We're strongly opposed to the process by which they want to bring it to market on these overhead lines. So that cost, you know, if you look at energy generation and the environment, and it's always a trade-off. There's always pluses and minuses. We think the project can be done in a way where the benefits may equal the costs. The way it's proposed right now, because of the impact on our physical environment, the cost is just too high. There are a lot of other cost-benefit issues relative to Northern Pass, but that's the big one for us.
Great. Jim, you just heard Will say that he thinks the costs outweigh the benefits of the electricity that will be brought in. Supporters of Northern Pass say we need Northern Pass to lower electric rates in New Hampshire. What do you think? Do we need Northern Pass to lower electric rates here?
First, Judy, thanks for having me on. That 30 years went by really fast. I think that an answer to that question is my view is that New Hampshire, and because we're part of a regional market, does not need Northern Pass to lower electric rates. In fact, the market has changed considerably since the project was first proposed in 2010. When Northern Pass originally came into New Hampshire, New England, and wanted to bring power down from Canada, electric energy wholesale prices were relatively high. They were in the 8-9 cents a kilowatt hour to produce and sell electricity in the wholesale market. And so it looked attractive back then. But a couple of major things have happened since then. First of all, the wholesale prices dropped dramatically because of the availability of low-cost natural gas to power a new fleet of very efficient natural gas plants that have been brought online. And meanwhile, the cost of the project has almost doubled. I think when it was originally proposed, it was going to cost $1.1 billion. Now I estimate the cost to be at least $1.8 billion, and that's just on the U.S. side. There's probably another $500 to $600 million in construction on the Canadian side of the budget. So the project is, from my perspective, is probably not apt to have much of an impact on energy prices in New England. Not to get too deep into the weeds, there isn't an element of the energy market in New Hampshire referred to as the capacity market, and that's a process that's established by the regional independent system operator to ensure that there's enough power available looking into the future, and that's the forward capacity market. There had been an argument that somehow the putting 1,000 megawatts or 1,090 megawatts into the forward capacity market would help reduce that component of the energy costs, but increasingly the economics of that proposal are falling apart as they're being examined as well. So that's kind of a long and perhaps a little too complex an answer for you, Judy, but to those that say we need Northern Pass to lower electric rates, I think there's a two-part answer. One is we've lowered them considerably. They're the lowest they've been in 15 years without Northern Pass, and any benefits that may come are probably going to be pretty de minimis if they exist at all, and if they do, they'll be in that small sliver of the market, which is the forward capacity market.
How much would Northern Pass possibly lower electric rates? What are the estimates that are being discussed?
Well, as I said, you know, I don't believe that it will, but I think the best case scenario is that the advocates for Northern Pass and their paid consultants have suggested is that looking ahead, it may have a potential impact of a 3 to 5% reduction in energy costs. But that's projecting forward. It's several years before the project is even electrified and online, and there's lots of changes taking place in the market. The most dramatic being that the demand for energy has been flat, and because of energy efficiency and more efficient power plants, that 3 to 5% probably is not the end of the day going to be available in savings.
Jim, you said New Hampshire has the lowest electric rates in 15 years without Northern Pass, yet electric rates seem to be still creeping up. Why is that?
Yeah, so if your electric bill includes a couple of components, the energy component is the electric generator is making electrons and send them across the wires. That's the energy, and then, as I said, the capacity component. That's unregulated. It's a very competitive market, and it's where the benefits of natural gas and generation have really dramatically lowered the price of electricity. The other part of your bill is the delivery part of it, and that's the poles and wires and substations that need to get the energy from the generation station to your house. That continues to be a regulated activity, so the regulated utilities control that, and prices there have been skyrocketing. Increase in the transmission, depending on the utility that serves you in New England, there's been as much as a 400% increase in that transmission delivery charge paid to the utilities. So while the price of electricity may have dropped from 8 cents a kilowatt hour to 4 cents a kilowatt hour, it is being offset by the utilities' regulated transmission prices.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Will, as you know, because you're there almost every day, right now hearings are taking place before what's called the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee to determine whether Northern Pass will be granted a site certificate, basically the permit to allow it to construct the transmission lines. Will, what does Northern Pass have to prove in order to get a site certificate?
Well, the state law that governs the Site Evaluation Committee has four basic findings that they have to, they being the seven-member subcommittee, have to review and make a decision on. And the burden of proof is on Northern Pass as the applicant to clear those four findings. One has to do with making it clear that they have the financial and managerial capacity to build and operate the facility. And while I don't think there's any debate about the financial capacity of the two partners to do this, there seems to be some question as to whether the two partners are in sync about the $1.8 billion cost of the project and who's going to pay for what. That's sort of a separate issue. But if they're not in agreement, then I suppose there's an issue that the managerial capacity question is not resolved. The second issue is the seven decision makers have to be persuaded that there's not an unreasonable adverse impact on aesthetics, on natural resources, on historic resources and landscapes, on water quality, air quality, public health and safety, and I'm probably forgetting one or two, but each of those, if any one of those bars isn't cleared, then they don't get a permit. The third finding that has to be made is that there's no undue adverse impact on the orderly development of the region or regions impacted by the project. This is a significant hurdle in the case of Northern Pass because they're actually going through 31 New Hampshire municipalities, and that region or those multiple regions are actively arguing at the SEC as we speak that their local economies are going to be adversely impacted by the project. And the fourth and final finding that the seven decision makers have to address is whether the project is in the public interest. And this is a new legislatively prescribed finding that's really going to be tested in this particular project, not for the first time, but the first time that a large transmission line has had to come through the project is in the public interest is actually going to be made. So it's kind of the SEC committee is somewhat plowing new ground here, but it'll be interesting to see how they manage that particular decision. But those four things are the things that the committee itself has to decide on. Those are the four thresholds that the applicant has to document that they've been able to attain. And of course, you know, we're in the position of arguing that they have failed to do that.
Well, this is probably a good time to take a brief commercial break for our advertisers. Stay tuned. Come on back for more of Protect the Granite State with Will Abbott and Jim Monahan. Welcome back to Protect the Granite State. I'm Judy Reardon, and joining me today is Jim Monahan, managing partner of the DuPont Group and an expert on energy issues, and Will Abbott, the vice president of the Forest Society, leading conservation group in New Hampshire. Before the break, Will, you were telling us what Northern Pass has to prove in order to get a site certificate or permit in New Hampshire. One of the things you mentioned was that they have to show they will not have an unreasonable adverse impact on aesthetics. As I understand that means that they can't have an unreasonable adverse visual impact. Could you talk about that a little more? You referenced it at the beginning of the show, but can you try to give people a picture of what the potential visual impacts are of Northern Pass?
Yeah, this is clearly for us anyway, the big issue. There are many others that other people are concerned about, but in order to document that you don't have an unreasonable adverse impact on aesthetics, there are a set of rules that the Site Evaluation Committee has developed for assessing the impact on aesthetics. And so there's something called a visual impact analysis that's required, and there's a set of rules that govern how that analysis is done. The applicant hired a landscape architect who's an expert in visual analysis to do their so-called VIA. We hired an expert to do a critique of the Northern Pass VIA. The Council for the Public, who's under the law, the Attorney General's office designates an assistant attorney general to serve as the counsel for the public at these proceedings. And the counsel for the public's job is to give the application a very swift kick in the tires to make sure that the application has, essentially met the minimum thresholds for the application requirements under the SEC statute. And then they proceed to hire experts at the expense of the applicant to test those findings that have to be made. And so they hired an expert to do a critique of the applicant's visual impact analysis. I think there's a mechanical process for assessing visual impact, but there's also a very subjective part to this that is something the SEC has to do, and that is, you can't create a mathematical formula to spit out an answer to the question of is it or is it not unreasonable adverse impact on aesthetics. It's just not something that you can quantify entirely. So the subjective part of this is really hard, and it's a tough decision that the SEC has to make. But we would argue that, the seven decision makers have to look at the visual impact analysis that's been proposed and critiqued, but they also have to look at the larger question of, what will be the impact of this power line on these landscapes that are going to be populated with this industrial set of structures where they don't exist right now. And, the applicant has kind of taken the position at the SEC hearings that because a large chunk of the 132-mile above the ground part of the project is in an existing right-of-way, that therefore there's no new visual impact because there's already, a power line in the existing right-of-way. Well, the power line that's in the existing right-of-way is largely on wooden poles that are 40 to 45 feet tall. The Northern Pass project are steel monopoles and steel erector set type structures that are up to 160 feet high, well above tree line. And so the argument that somehow there's no change in the visual impact by adding this new facility into the existing right-of-way, at least in our view, is quite preposterous, but that's the argument that they seem to be making. And the visual impact here is going to be experienced in the majority of the communities that are impacted by the project.
We're here in Concord, and people tend, I think, to think of Northern Pass as having an impact on the North Country, but as I understand it, the highest towers, 160 feet high, are going to be in Concord. And so
that's right on Interstate 393, crossing I-393 up by the Concord Heights.
So they're going to be taller than the State House. They're going to be visible from Main Street, downtown Concord, and the city of Concord has invested so much money in upgrading downtown Concord, and you're going to have these poles that are 160 feet high. And Jim, the new tower lines, if they're built, are going to be near where you live, aren't they?
Yeah, they're going to be. I live on the east side of Concord. I'll see them every day as I drive home, and maybe see them from my backyard. I'm not quite sure. I think they maybe Will can fill us in a little more about that. But I think, as a general matter, the visual pollution of these industrial towers are going to be part of Concord for the next 40 years.
Yeah.
Actually, I think the Concord City Council and the City Solicitor's Office deserves a lot of credit and maybe some more public support for the work that they're doing at the Site Evaluation Committee to kind of raise these concerns about the impacts. As I understand, they're not necessarily opposing the project, but they're saying, look, if you can bury it through other parts of New Hampshire to avoid the visual impacts. Why can't you bury it through Concord, where, you know, tens of thousands of people are going to be exposed to it on a daily basis?
Jim, earlier in the show, you said that you estimated the current estimate for the cost of Northern Pass is $1.8 billion. The company still says $1.6 billion.
Mm-hmm.
How long has the company been saying it's going to cost $1.6 billion?
I think when they decided, the prices creeped up over time. It was originally $1.1 billion. And then I think in 2015, when they proposed to bury 60 miles of it, they pushed the price up to 1.6. But I also calculate in the $200 million Ford New Hampshire plan that will be paid for out of the project as a cost that they have to recover through it. So that's why I've been comfortable saying it's $1.8 billion. And frankly, if you look at both Eversource and Hydro-Québec, I don't think there's a single example of them building something on time and under budget.
And one of the other interesting things is that the 52 miles of burial and that Northern Pass is proposing in Grafton County, largely to avoid putting overhead towers through the White Mountain National Forest, a lot of that, the location of where physically in what roads this is going to be done, hasn't been finalized yet. And so, if anything, the cost of actually building the project as they're proposing to is likely to go up once they determine where in the ground they're going to put the physical structures that are required to support a buried line.
That's true. And, you know, Will, you bring up the buried lines. I want to look at that more closely a little bit later in the show, because although, you know, I certainly understand why the city of Concord would like to see the lines buried through Concord if it's going to happen. But as I understand it, there's a lot of problems for the communities where the burial is going to occur. Jim, going back to the cost, you just said that Eversource and Hydro-Québec don't have a good track record of finishing projects on time and under budget. What has been Eversource's track record in New Hampshire on building projects cost estimates?
Well, obviously the most recent example is one nearby Concord, and that is the Mercury Scarber that was put on Merrimack Station. They had originally approached the legislature and asked for the opportunity to make that investment outside of the statutory structure and be able to collect the cost from ratepayers, and claimed it was going to cost $250 million. At the end of the day, it ended up costing almost $450 million. It led to the total uneconomic operation of that plant and has led to the company stepping forward and deciding to sell off all of their assets just because they had created such an uneconomic situation. So that's a very clear example of major cost overruns. And I think, you know, they were responsible. You know, they were the folks that brought Seabrook that came in, you know, nearly $1 billion over budget as well. So.
You know, I was a kid when the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant was first proposed by PSNH. And at that time, they said the power will be so cheap, we won't even need to meter it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the reasons that New Hampshire's electric rates skyrocketed in the 90s and early 2000s was because of how they built the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant and also led to their bankruptcy. It's time for another commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the impact of Northern Pass in the communities where they're saying they're going to bury the lines. Welcome back to Protect the Granite State, a new show that's focusing on the impacts of the giant Northern Pass project on the state of New Hampshire. Before the break, we were talking about the cost estimates for Northern Pass. Currently, the company says $1.6 billion. That's seemingly higher than their original estimate. And we also talked about the fact that they're going to bury 52 miles of the project if they can build it bury 52 miles through the White Mountain National Forest, and Will Abbott from the Forest Society was saying that it's likely that the cost of that is going to be much higher than the company has been projecting. But, Will, what I want to talk about is the impacts of the burial on the communities. I was really struck this summer when a couple from Clarksville, a tiny town in the northernmost part of New Hampshire, came into the SEC at a public statement hearing and talked about the fact that the burial as proposed by Northern Pass through Clarksville is going to dig up a cemetery, and that Northern Pass's maps had not shown that they were going to do that, which, you know, makes me anyway wonder whether there are a lot of places where they're not accurately mapping it and may have impacts that aren't being discussed today. But can you tell us a little bit more about the concerns that towns along the burial route are raising?
Yeah, there are many concerns. And, you know, I want to say up front, you know, our organization has been lobbying aggressively that the entire line should be buried down an appropriate transportation corridor. We don't believe that the transportation corridors they've selected are appropriate. Up in the Coos County, what you were just referring to, there's 8 linear miles of underground, and they're only doing that because they can't build it overhead. It's not that they wanted to do it underground. They just can't figure out any other way to connect the dots without going underground in a couple of locations. And they're going underground on municipal roads that were never intended to host this kind of a structure. The 52 miles in Grafton County around the White Mountain National Forest is along routes 302, 18, 116, and 112, and Route 3 on a sort of a, it's not a direct line by any stretch, but it goes from Bethlehem to Bridgewater. And in a lot of locations where they're proposing to bury along these secondary roads, the width of the right-of-ways are narrow. The actual DOT right-of-way isn't designed, again, to host a facility of this magnitude. And so a lot of people are concerned that if their homes are right up against the road right-of-way, that this installation is going to perpetually alter their daily lives. And they're extremely concerned about it, and with good reason. If, you know, an alternative that the company has never been willing to contemplate, the state of New Hampshire actually owns a right-of-way corridor along Route 93 that's 300 to 400 feet wide. The two barrels of I-93 don't take up they take up less than half of that width. So the state already owns a corridor, and in fact, the legislature in 2016 enacted a new policy that made Interstate 93 and the other interstate rights of way in the state, and then Route 101 between 93 and 95, as energy corridors that developers of energy projects, if they wanted to locate a facility, you know, the state policy now is those are the highways, rights of way you should use, not these secondary roads where the right of way can be, you know, 26 to 50 feet in width. So these are real issues.
You know, going down Interstate 93 seems to me that it would make so much more sense than going down these narrow state and local roads. Why didn't the company propose that?
Well, I'm probably not the right person to speak for the company, but their argument has been, well, it's going to cost $1 billion more. And, you know, my response to that is the same as former U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte, who said the state of New Hampshire is worth that investment. You know, it's worth spending that extra money in order to protect our landscapes. But you know, I another way of thinking about it is if the thing that makes this power inexpensive is the scars on the New Hampshire landscapes, that's definitely a trade-off that New Hampshire should not make. And if we you know, if we look seriously at the I-93 corridor and we look seriously at what the engineering requirements would be for the facility in that corridor, it certainly makes sense that you could bring power down Interstate 91 from the Quebec-Vermont border in Derby Line, Vermont, down I-91 and then down I-93 to Boston. Or you could go directly down to Hartford on I-91 through Vermont and Massachusetts. And those corridors seem to be, and the legislature in New Hampshire has determined them to be, logical places for this kind of structure to be located.
Boy, you know, it just seems so irrational to me that Northern Pass doesn't want to do that. And you know, you said the reason you believe is that it will cost more money. But, you know, time is also money. And I don't think there would have been the objections to Northern Pass that we're seeing if they had proposed doing that. And
In fact, I think to prove your point there, I think you're absolutely right. In Vermont, there's a private power line project designed to bring 1,000 megawatts of Canadian electricity to the New England grid that's totally buried. And it's got all its permits. It's ready to go. And that project figured out a way to make it work economically. So it raises a big question as to, you know, is this billion-dollar claim of what the true additional cost would be, is it correct? I don't buy it personally, but they've never documented what that $1 billion buys and where on the ground it would buy it. But, you know, this might be a great irony in the end, but it may be that another project or competing project in the marketplace may edge out Northern Pass on economic grounds for some of the reasons Jim was talking about earlier, and because there are other projects that are ready to go that have very little opposition. I actually went to one of the public hearings on the Vermont project a couple of years ago. There were 20 people in the audience, and where, you know, we had 700 or 800 per hearing here in New Hampshire. And most of the people who came were supportive of it because it was underground.
Jim, what are some of the other energy projects that are being proposed in New England that could provide the same amount of power as Northern Pass would?
Yeah, there are. You know, when Northern Pass was really originally proposed in 2010, frankly, you know, that's longer than World War II that this thing has been going on. It was kind of the only game in town. But since then, there's been a number of other projects that have been proposed as an alternative to Northern Pass to bring power from Quebec into New England and into New York. The one we'll reference is being developed by a company called TDI. It goes underwater through Lake Champlain and then underground to get to grid through Vermont. There is a project being proposed through northern Maine into the region. But in addition to the big hydro projects, there's also thousands of megawatts of generation that's being proposed in New England. That's a range of, you know, large bulk facilities that are being built to turn natural gas into electricity. There are wind farms being proposed all over northern Maine and in parts of New Hampshire. And then anyone who drives up and down the highways and around the neighborhoods is seeing a lot of solar pop up as well. All of those things were not contemplated in 2010 when the Northern Pass project was proposed. And in addition to that, the concept of offshore wind was more whimsical, I guess, back in 2010. And now we're seeing real projects being proposed for offshore wind as well. So I think the Northern Pass project, in my view, is really a solution to a 2008 problem that is going past us. And by the time if it were to ever be developed, there'd be lots of other things that would step in and take its place.
This is probably a good time to take a break. You'll be hearing from our WKXL's great advertisers. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Northern Pass's impact on New Hampshire with Jim Monahan and Will Abbott. Welcome back to Protect the Granite State. We're here to discuss the impacts of Northern Pass on the state of New Hampshire, including the city of Concord. With me is Jim Monahan and Will Abbott. Jim, before the break, we were talking about some of the competing projects to Northern Pass that are being proposed in New England. I know Northern Pass has submitted a proposal in response to something called the Massachusetts Clean Power RFP. Jim, what's that about?
So the state of Massachusetts a couple years or a year and a half or so ago passed legislation to try to increase the amount of low carbon or zero carbon energy that would be brought into the Massachusetts market. That legislation was strongly supported by Eversource. And the way it proposes to work is that a request for proposal was issued to bring low-carbon resources into the market. And I think at the time the bill was originally passed, I think Eversource's hopes were they would be the only one that would bid, and the bid would be Northern Pass. This turned out not to be the case. 42 different projects have been proposed. Three major projects that are proposed include taking power from Hydro-Quebec. So even Hydro-Quebec, I think, is spreading its risk around, and maybe it's not going to go to Northern Pass. And so the cost of that RFP would be borne by the ratepayers in Massachusetts. I think they'll see some rate shock when they actually realize that they're paying $2 billion for something. It might be Northern Pass or more likely something else. But that's really going to dictate the economics, I think, of whether or not Northern Pass succeeds. By all accounts, both in the industry and what we're hearing at the Site Evaluation Committee, Northern Pass project just is uneconomic. It can't be built without a subsidy. And the subsidy that they're betting the bank on is winning the Massachusetts RFP. You know, to make that a little local, even though you think it's all taking place in Boston, the folks that have a vote on that RFP are the major utilities. There's National Grid. They have about 35% of the vote. Eversource, which has about 45% of the vote, and Unitil has about 20% of the vote. And Unitil is Concord, New Hampshire's electric company. So for all the folks that are grouchy about what's going to happen with towers and undue impacts on Concord, they probably would be surprised to learn that the swing vote and whether or not Northern Pass gets built could well be their local electric company here in Concord.
Wow. So I want to make sure I understand this correctly, Jim. You're saying that the utilities in Massachusetts will make the decision, and the utility with the largest number of votes is Eversource. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, there's been a lot of concern in Massachusetts about whether or not the system is transparent enough and was appropriately set up, because the decision to spend a couple billion dollars of ratepayer money is now being made by a couple of the utilities that had a vested stake in it, that they get to pick themselves, is the concern.
And tell me if I'm wrong. My understanding is it was the utilities that pushed that legislation through.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I work for one of my clients is the New England Power Generators Association, and they had a lot of concerns about it. And among the concerns was that this was being proposed by, you know, the regulated – being advocated on behalf by the regulated monopoly and disrupting the level playing field of the generation market in the region.
When will the decision likely be made on who wins the mass RFP?
It's a two-step process. The selection process is supposed to take place before the end of January. It could happen sooner than that. Then whichever project is selected then goes to the utilities to seek and try to negotiate a contract. That should take place in April. And then once the utilities select who to contract with, the thought is that it would go into rates once those projects are constructed. I think there'll be a long litigation period in the middle there.
And so, Jim, will we know in January which bid got the highest score? Or are they going to keep that secret until they've negotiated a deal?
I don't think it's clear yet. I think the general expectation, and certainly the Massachusetts Attorney General's office is at the table and supervising it. They've been pushing for as much transparency as possible in some measure way to offset the concerns around self-dealing.
You know, it's one of the things that I might have you back, Jim, for another show to talk about competition in the energy market, because when New Hampshire broke up PSNH's monopoly 20 years ago and brought competition to the energy side of the market, I know people like you were raising concerns about making sure that the parent company didn't go ahead and start creating affiliates to do power generation that would then be, have a favored spot. But
that's a whole other show. Yeah.
Will, I want to go back to the site evaluation committee. What's the status? Where is that process at?
So we're kind of in the second half. Analogize this to, like a soccer game. We're in the second half, and we're probably in the second half of the hearing. The hearing is the evidentiary hearing at which all of the parties who are involved in the case bring their information and testimony to the table. They're all cross-examined by one another, and then at the end of the evidentiary hearing, there's a decision to close the record, and all of the decisions that need to be made about what's in the record and what's not in the record get done. And then you move into what's called the deliberative phase. Right now, the schedule is that the hearing will come to an end in December before Christmas, and the next step in the deliberative phase is that all of the parties, and there are 146 or 7 to this particular project, all the parties will file what's called a post-hearing hearing memorandum, which is their final sort of written argument. And so that will take some time. There needs to be time for the 7 members of the SEC to actually read all of those filings. And then once that's done, and that's projected to be done by the end of January, there will be a public series of sessions at which the 7 decision makers will actually discuss in public amongst themselves those 4 findings we talked about earlier in the program. And they will have to make a determination as to whether the applicant has sufficiently met the burden of proof for each finding. And if they make the decision that they haven't, then they don't get the permit. If they make the decision that they have, then they will make a vote to approve a permit, and in this case, if they do that, most likely there will be dozens of conditions put on the permit, and it will take time for them to determine, and they have to do this in this public deliberative session, not only whether the 4 findings have been met or not, but if they have, then they have to determine whether there are any conditions that the permit will include before finally voting on it. And that whole process is expected to be concluded by the end of February, and then it will probably take another month to write a final decision, and the written document is what becomes operative, and until there's a written decision issued, there is no final decision by the SEC. So it's a pretty cumbersome process by design, and the irony here is that the decision-making actually occurs between those 2 points that you and Jim were just talking about in the mass RFP process. So it could be that a winner in the mass RFP is chosen before the SEC actually makes a decision. And if we don't know who the winner is until after the SEC makes a decision, it's possible that the winner of the mass RFP could be somebody other than Northern Pass, and you sort of have to twitch your eyebrows at why does the state of New Hampshire spend 2 years going through a regulatory review process when the marketplace itself could essentially choose another winner here, you know, and anyway, that's where we are.
Thanks, Will. And that's probably a good place to wrap up this hour, which has gone by quickly. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Will. And thank you all out there for listening. Make your voice heard. You can still submit a written comment to the site evaluation committee. Get your voice out there. Thank you.